Back in church history. Lesson 5. Lessons from church history. Lesson 5. There's 12 lessons, and we've done 4. We have today and then 2 weeks to finish. But that's not going to happen, so just enjoy ourselves. Christianity planted among the nations. We're looking at another era now, 591 to 1049. And the reason for those is because of 2 popes that are elected at those years. This we call this the missionary endeavor and the conversion of the nations. Now, we mentioned in one of the earlier sessions that the first missionaries, they went to civilized places. But now in this era, they're going into places where there's no civilization. There is no law. There's no alphabet. There's really no literature, no agriculture, no laws, no arts. So the gospel is not only going to go and be a message of salvation, but the missionaries actually have to set up a civilization. And there's a big difference between the gospel winning people in a nation and the gospel taking root in a nation. That's why generally when we look at, if you look at almost any survey of church history, it starts, of course, in Jerusalem and moves west. And there's a whole fascinating teaching about the westward movement of the gospel. Now, that doesn't mean that missionaries didn't go east and there were people getting saved. Almost certainly Thomas made it to India and planted a congregation there, and Mark made it to Egypt and other places. So certainly they moved out in the east. But the gospel took root in culture in a westward movement. So it takes root in the European culture and then crosses the ocean at a unique time. You know, the first people that came to America, 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. All children had to learn that little rhyme, so you always know 1492. But there's not a permanent settlement established in America till 1607. Now, the reason for that, from a providential viewpoint, is if America had been colonized in 1492, it would have been all Roman Catholicism. But see, something very significant happens, the Protestant Reformation, 1517, and now all of America's roots, the gospel is being transplanted into America and taking root in the culture. And America had their turn and their time. But now we see the gospel taking root in culture is moved across the Pacific Ocean. And the next major wave, and of course Stephen Mansfield was referring to this quite a lot when he was here, and even not saying it, that was undergirding a lot of his prophetic statements, is we see a very clear evidence throughout history that the gospel has moved westward as it's rooted and taken over culture. And that's why, you know, if you had a village of 100 people, 60 of them in the village would be Asians. And that's where the gospel is having the biggest effect. And not only in the number of people getting saved, but beginning to bust out and to affect worldviews and culture. And so we can expect in our lifetime, in our children's lifetime, more and more of that happening, the gospel taking root and influencing culture.
Yes.
Not just, we'll still keep getting a lot of people saved, but the next level now of discipling nations.
Yes.
Discipling nations. So this is the beginning of it. They start discipling the nations of Europe, and which have been totally decimated by the barbarians, and starting on a new foundation. A foundation that is Christian, but it's also extremely religious, too. So the missionary labor of the Middle Ages was a process of converting nations through spiritual means, political influence, and in some cases, military force. So we took over your area. Now everyone will accept our religion or will be killed. You can really bring up your numbers. with that, you know? Evangelism crusades, parties. I mean, you just get 100% conversions. We'll look at some of them in particular. England is first. The missionary history of Great Britain is divided into two periods. The Celtic, not Celtic, although there are the Boston Celtics, but the term is Celtic, and the Anglo-Saxons. So the Celts were animists. They were the Druids. They worshiped nature deities, followed the Druids, probably erected Stonehenge. Been to Stonehenge twice. It's really disappointing. It sure looks a lot bigger in the pictures. You get there, this is it? I mean, they're a little taller than that ceiling.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but not much more. Yeah. I mean, there's still an impressive architectural feat to get them, because they probably came from 50 to 100 miles away, and they were transported and set up. But yeah, it's like, I'm glad I came, but I was hoping for a little bit more pizzazz.
Maybe the people were 4 footers.
Yeah. Little English people. Yeah. So how the gospel came to Celtic England, we don't know. But a real genuine Christian civilization had taken over a good part of England in the 3rd, 4th century. There is speculation that Paul made it to England. It's a possibility. Clement refers in his letter to the Corinthians that Paul went to the uttermost west and finished his mission. Most people think that's Spain, and it probably was. But at that time, mid-60s, England was a part of the Roman Empire. So there is some possibility that Paul got all the way to England. There's thoughts that maybe Peter, Philip, John, or the most popular one is Joseph of Arimathea. Right? You know, the Holy Grail. Right? Remember Indiana Jones and the whole Holy Grail thing. So I've been to Glastonbury in England, which was the home of King Arthur. And there's some fascinating things about Glastonbury. There is plant life that grows there. The only other place that grows in the world is around Jerusalem.
Wow. What kind of plant?
I've forgotten the name of it.
Yeah.
No. It's a flowering plant that's only in Glastonbury and in certain parts of Jerusalem. And so there's all kinds of legends that, you know, Jesus came to England as a lad with Joseph of Arimathea, who was a tin merchant, because that's the reason why Rome went, is there was big tin deposits in England. And I think they are legend, but I have examined them pretty thoroughly, and there's a little bit of evidence, but most likely it was traitors. You know, because Roman, everybody's going there from Rome, save people, leading people to Christ, and then leaving some of the Romans, because the Romans come, you know, Julius Caesar comes to England in his reign, 55 BC, but then by the time Paul is converted, the year Paul is converted, actually, London is established as a community. So the city of London dates back to Paul's conversion, 33 AD. And Rome had already come and had taken over large sections of England at that time. So the gospel came very early to England. And a whole Celtic Christianity grew up. And there's still, if you go to parts of England, there's still a Celtic Christianity. It's they're not in connection with Rome. And they're a lot more mystical, you know. And they, you know, Patrick and all of those kind of guys, they're interested in the old saints like that. But in 410, I referred to this when we talked about Augustine, the city of God. 410, the city of Rome is sacked. And the barbarians are at the gates. And so prior to that, in 407, Rome pulls all of its legionaries out of England. At this point, England had gone as far, or the Romans had gone as far as northern England, not quite to the Scottish border, and they built this wall. It's an amazing wall. It's 79 miles wide. It goes from one sea to the other sea, completely traverses the whole nation. And it was a massive wall, much thicker than this room and much higher than this room. And every mile they had outposts, and they manned this wall against the Scots. The Scots, the Picts they were called at that time, were trying to invade. That's as far as they got. But I've stood on Hadrian's Wall. Parts of it are still intact. These guys knew how to build stuff. It's still there. The only reason why most of it's gone is because they took most of the stone to build the churches during the Middle Ages. But in 407, they're all called away. And here you've got this civilization which is very ripe for the conquest. And you got the Angles and the Saxons and the Frisians and the Jutes, these Germanic tribes who worship Odin and follow Thor. Whoa. Yeah. Sounds like a good title for a sermon series. And I'm excited about the movie coming out, but you know, these were vicious pagans. And so they come, the first raids start in the 350s, but really by 449, there's massive waves of these Angles and Saxon tribes, and they almost totally eradicate the church. I mean, they just about kill every Christian, every minister in the whole nation. And Christianity only survives on the outskirts, like in Cornwall, which is in the farther southwest portion of England, and in Wales, and then up in the Scottish fringes. Completely wipe them out. And there's tales of just destroying, raping. I mean, it's like the Vikings, everything we know about the Vikings. These are pre-Vikings, but just raped the whole nation. And so they begin to take over. Now, Pope Gregory sent the Benedictine abbot Augustine, not Augustine. This is Augustine died in 430 or something like that. Augustine, we call him St. Augustine of Canterbury to distinguish him from Augustine of Hippo, sent him to evangelize the Anglo-Saxons in 597. King Ethelbert of Kent met the strangers, listened to them preach. He was converted and baptized and gradually drew his whole nation after him. Now, there's a fascinating story. Gregory is, before he becomes pope, he is in the Roman slave market. And he sees these three boys. They're Anglo-Saxons. And you know, Anglo-Saxons are noted because they're blonde hair, blue-eyed, which really stands out in Rome. And so he sees these beautiful children, and he talks to them. He says, "Where are you from?" And he said, we're Anglos, which sounds like the Roman word for angel. And says, "Oh, yeah, angels." And he said, "Where are you from?" Well, they're from a province in England, at one of the Saxon kingdoms called Deira, D-E-I-R-A. Now, the Latin word for wrath is I-R-A. So someone who's irate, you see, is wrath. And D undoes it. So it's, angels saved from the wrath of God. And then who is your ruler? And the ruler was a queen by the name of Aella, which when they said it, it sounded like, hallelujah. And so Gregory took this as a sign that the praises of God would be preached and sung in your nation. And he set about as a missionary to go to evangelize the Angles and the Saxons. But before he could raise his team, they made him pope against his will. And so he looks for somebody to go, and he finds Augustine. Augustine does not want to go. These are like, if you think of the nastiest headhunters, like Michael, think about the worst mission story, the worst people group, cannibals. These are the Angles and the Saxons. And Augustine does not want to go, but the Pope made him an offer he just couldn't refuse. So he made him go. So he's got his team of people, and they're going through Gaul, this is France, getting close to it, and they hear reports, people fleeing from there, reports of these Anglo-Saxons, and that's it. Augustine says, Pope or no Pope, I'm going home. So he goes back home. The Pope obviously deals with him, threatens to send him to hell or, you know, excommunicate him, whatever, the same thing. And so finally, Augustine says, okay, I'll go. And he crosses over, not far from where Dover is, a little bit farther to the north. There's actually a cross there marked on the spot where Augustine landed. And in the meantime, now watch the providence of God here, even the providence of God in our fear and weakness. In between when Augustine would have arrived, if he had just followed God and just done what he was told to do, and the time he actually gets there after he's a coward and runs home, the king of the southern Saxon kingdom of Kent, by the name of Ethelbert, his wife Bertha, her sister gets saved in France and comes and visits her and leads her to Christ. And so now she's witnessing to her husband, who's a converted, I mean, he's a staunch pagan in his whole nation. They're Thor worshiping pagans. But his wife's converted, and now Augustine, trembling, thinking he's going to be flayed and cut and killed, and he shows up, and Ethelbert says, well, to honor my wife, you can come preach. And he comes and preaches, and there's this particular sermon, one of the great sermons in history, really. Ethelbert's got all of his knights and all of his noble people around, and they're in this big... If you kind of imagine the Rohirrim from Lord of the Rings, that's who Tolkien patterned the Anglo-Saxons. So that big hall of Theoden, you know, kind of picture one of those big halls. They're all in there. He's preaching. And there's an open window, and a bird flies in one end and flies out the other. And Ethelbert, it's like a sign. See, we don't know where the bird was before they came in, and we don't know where it'll go afterwards. So we don't know where we were before we came on this earth. And we don't know what's going to happen after we die. But he said, if your message can give us assurance about where we go after we die, we will accept it. And he was converted and had, of course, all of his knights. Then, you know, when the king gets converted, you know, it's a good thing.
Yes.
Yeah, I want to go. And so on Christmas Day 597... 10,000 of Ethelbert's subjects were baptized in Canterbury. And I've been on the site where that happened and been to Augustine's grave site. At that point, there was the beginning of the gospel reemerging into England. And so there were seven Saxon kingdoms at that time, and gradually the gospel begins to spread throughout the nation. Ireland is number three. The former slave Patrick was the apostle to the Irish. Patrick, yes, St. Patrick, and he was a saint. Fascinating man. Now, he's a Brit, okay? Which don't tell any Irish people that their pagans, their patron saint is actually a Brit. Yeah, because that's, you know, that's painful. Because, you know, the Irish, you know, they have an inferiority complex about the English. And so they make up with it by just cussing and yelling and talking real loud. So St. Paddy's about all they got. He's actually an Englishman. But because, now he's living, we're talking about 389 probably to maybe 461. This is the range. And so this is the time now, as when he's a boy, Rome, remember, they're pulling all their legionnaires back to Rome. And so there's pirates everywhere. They live on the west coast of England, and pirates come and take Patrick's family. They kill his parents, rape his sister. They take him and they sell him to, they take him over to the Druids in Ireland, and they're selling slaves over there. And so Patrick is sold as a slave as a young man. And he's in slavery for about 6 years. Now, he's a church kid. His dad's a deacon. He's raised in church, you know. He's been going to Sunday school and, you know, doing the little recitals and doing the whole thing. But it's not a real faith. But now he's a slave. And he gets real desperate for God. So he starts crying out to God and praying to God. And God meets him at that time. He has a powerful encounter with him. He's truly born again. And he has a vision, a dream, actually. God shows him how to escape from captivity. So where to go and where to walk. And so he left. He followed the plan from the dream. He escapes and he gets on board a ship. Actually gets captured by some other pirates, but through a whole series of things, he goes back to England, and he's doing pretty good, but he has a dream one night, and he sees this man by the name of Victoricus, and he's standing up, and he hears the voice of the Irish, what he called it. He hears all these Irish children in the background, and they're chanting to him, "Oh, holy man, walk among us once more. Walk among us once more." And he feels like God is calling him to go back to his land of his captivity and preach the gospel. So he goes to the continent, gets trained for a number of years, and he goes boldly into a world of druids, human sacrifice, and essentially the entire nation is converted. Wow. Genuinely converted. Evangelized the whole nation. He had times where he would challenge the Druid priests with Elijah-like challenges, and God would come through with miracles, and the power of the Druids was broken, and the gospel was really planted. And from Ireland, the gospel, that became a major mission-sending nation. Thomas Cahill, who's a Roman Catholic historian, wrote a book called How the Irish Saved Civilization. What happened is at the sack of Rome, all of the literature of the ancient world was destroyed. But the Irish monks had copied all of that literature and language and all the books, all of the early, not only the Bible books, but also the early fathers. And so if we didn't have the Irish monks, we wouldn't, all of civilization would have been lost. Essentially. So the gospel goes out from Ireland and the whole place is evangelized. He says, "I am greatly a debtor to God who has bestowed his grace so largely upon me that multitudes were born again to God through me. The Irish, who never had the knowledge of God and worshipped only idols and unclean things, have lately become the people of the Lord and are called sons of God." Very powerful. Less than a century after Patrick's death, and it really is a shame. Of course, it's big in our country. St. Patrick, probably not too big. A lot of Irish, you know. So Chicago, I mean, the Chicago River, they dye it green on St. Patrick's Day. They dye the whole river green in honor. And it's just really one big party. Ireland was covered with churches and monasteries, training missionaries and transcribing sacred books. During the 6th and 7th century, Ireland sent missionaries to Scotland, England, France, Germany, Switzerland, and Italy. Yeah, Joseph.
Why is green associated with that?
I think it's the clover, right? It's the clover, yeah. Have you ever seen pictures of Ireland? It's green. First of all, it rains a lot there. You know, but the kind of rain you get in Ireland is not the kind of rain we get here, where you get nothing, 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 and monsoon. There's like always a mist, which is perfect for the greenery. So, I mean, the most beautiful flowers and gardens in the world in the British Isles because of that continual mist. Yeah, Edgar?
Is it just legendary or is it true?
The snakes?
The snakes is driven out by
Patrick. It's legendary, right. Yeah. There are no snakes in Ireland.
Yes.
No, there's no snakes there, so... they're just known there. I don't know. Why are there no lions in the Philippines? I don't know.
It's metaphorical when he drove out all the quote-unquote snakes out of the land.
Yeah, that's supposedly He chased all the snakes out. That's why there's none. That's just a legend, yeah. All right, Scotland, which is my homeland, in 563, Columba, C-O-L-U-M-B-A, not Columbo, Columba. Columba sailed from Ireland with 12 disciples to the west of Scotland. He was presented with the inhospitable island of Iona, and from there proceeded the Christianization of Scotland. Iona is a tidal island. Do you understand? Do you know what a tidal island is? I think you do. I know I saw the list of the number of Philippine islands, and it depends if it's high tide or low tide.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So Iona is a tidal island. That means when the tide is high, it's an island. When it's not, it's connected to the mainland, so you can drive across. I took my daughter on a Christian history tour of England and Scotland in 2005. We didn't get as far as Iona, but on the other coast, Lindisfarne, there is another tidal island like that. They call it the Holy Island, where Aidan came in 632, and all of northern England was evangelized from there. And it's tidal also, so you have to get out to the island, you have to consult the tide tables for that day. Because if you get out, you know, they got this big, long sort of causeway that you go out to, and half of the day, it's under 10 feet of water. And so they've got these big stilts and platforms on top in case you're driving and you get caught. You just kiss your car goodbye, but at least you climb up on the stilts and you live. Pretty fascinating. Yeah, we had quite an interesting time there. We made sure we consulted the tide tables and no fooling around. But you know, you're riding on the causeway, and 2 or 3 feet from the road on either side, the North Sea is, it's moving. It's lapping up right there. So Iona was a tidal island. It's only 3 miles long and about half a mile wide. Hardly anything grows there. It's totally inhospitable. But they said, you can have this place, because the Scots were total pagans, but you can have this little place. So he started a community and started training disciples and monks. And from there, they moved out and they evangelized all of Scotland. Matter of fact, have you heard of the Loch Ness Monster?
Yeah.
Now, you know, a loch, L-O-C-H, is Scottish. It's Gaelic for a lake. So the Loch Ness is Lake Ness. And Lake Ness is a very long, thin lake. Inverness, where they play golf, is at the top of it. And there's supposedly a monster there, right? The first recorded sighting, I mean, it's actually written down in Columba's writings. He's the first person that spotted the Loch Ness Monster. He was traveling across the lake on his way to convert the king at Inverness, and the monster shows up and grabs somebody in his boat and drags him down. And Columba, he recorded this, he rebuked the monster, commanded them to let go, and he did. The man was saved, and the monster swam off. It's the first recorded sighting from St. Columba. So that's all I'm going to say about that. No, I haven't been that far. All right, listen, we got a few more minutes, and we're actually filling in some blanks here. This is pretty good. Feeling good about our progress. Number five is France, the Franks. Franks, F-R-A-N-K-S, were the first of the Germanic tribes converted to Orthodox Christianity. Some of the Ostrogoths and the Visigoths, they were converted to Arian Christianity. But the Franks are the first ones who actually get converted to what we would call the Orthodox faith. And that's going to be important because that's going to lead to Charlemagne, who we'll talk about later. Germany. Now, Boniface, B-O-N-I-F-A-C-E. Huh? Yeah, essentially. Bonifacio. Was born in a noble English family around 680. He felt it his duty to Christianize those countries from which his Anglo-Saxon ancestors had emigrated. Remember, the Anglo-Saxons and the pagans had come, killed all the native Brits, and now they are, when you talk about, and there's a difference between being English and British. You know, English is a subset of British. So British specifically refers to the original Celtic peoples. So the British are the Welsh, people in Cornwall, the Irish, and the Scots. Those are officially British, Celtic, you see. The English are Angles, England, Angles. And so England, English is a subset of British. You can be British and not English, but you can't be English and not British. British is the whole thing, you see. So he wanted to, he's English, wants to go back, because all those pagans over there are still living in pagan idolatry. I feel responsible to go. So he sacrificed his prospects at home, crossed the channel, and began his missionary career with a few companions. And he essentially evangelized most of Germany. Well, he had a big showdown with the pagan priests. There was this massive oak tree at this one particular place. It was a sacred oak. It was called Thor's oak. And if you touched that, Thor's wrath would come upon you. Well, Boniface went straight to that oak, got a team of people, and they cut the whole thing down, made planks out of it, and built a church. And the pagans kept waiting. You watch, Thor's going to get you. They expected lightning bolts to come down and strike them dead, destroy the church. Nothing happens, and the gospel goes forth in power. He was martyred while reading the scriptures to new converts on Pentecost Sunday years later. Great stories, though, huh? Now, see, even in the midst of the religiosity and all the things we've talked about, there's still great men, heroes of the faith that are showing up. All right, some of the great leaders of the era. Gregory the Great. Gregory the Great, remember we met him in the slave market in Rome. He organized the papacy into an efficient administrative machine at a time when the rest of Europe was crumbling that would last through the Middle Ages. Gregory's an administrative genius. If he was alive today, he'd be running GE, or one of the top companies in the world. Just an organizational administrative genius. He was elected pope against his will, but his main dude was Augustine. And his main book was The City of God. So Gregory set it as his goal, we are going to do City of God. We're going to make it happen. That was his dream. We're going to make it a reality. We're going to bring the City of God here on earth. The total Christian society. He established many doctrines. Doctrines that are the cornerstone of Roman Catholicism today. For example, the writings of the church fathers are equal to scripture. The clergy must remain celibate. Yes, it goes back to Gregory, yeah. The Eucharist is a sacrifice for redemption. You know, the Mass, Christ is crucified again. Efficacious for the living and the dead. Right? You can help people get out of purgatory by doing so many masses. Yeah, goes back to Gregory. The doctrine of purgatorial fire, prayer to the saints, and the use of relics and amulets and devotions. So these were already circulating, but he established them. You see, so he took these ideas administratively, made sure that they were preached and practiced throughout Roman Catholicism everywhere. Yeah, he's an administrator, yeah.
Robert's asking, why didn't he see such a great leader who's done all this?
Well, that name came from the Roman Catholics, so that's Gregory the Great, you see. He's our man. Charlemagne, 742. So, you know, that's French for Charles the Great, right? Magnanimous, great. Oh, sorry, C-H-A-R-L-E. So Charles without the S, and then M-A-G-N-E. like Magna, only with an E. Built an empire that included most of Western and Central Europe. His ambition was to unite all the Teutonic, that's the German, and the Latin peoples on the continent under his reign in union with the Pope. So this is a grandiose vision. Let's get all of Europe united together under my authority and the Pope. Charlemagne founded schools, granted education to all male children, was a devout worshiper and liberal to the clergy, giving them tithes and appointing worthy bishops and abbots. So advance the church. Also extremely bloodthirsty. In one day, he once beheaded in cold blood almost 5,000 prisoners in one day. He just chopped off 5,000 heads in a day. While celebrating Christmas Mass in 800, Pope Leo III placed a golden crown upon him and crowned him head of the Holy Roman Empire. Which someone once said, the Holy Roman Empire was not holy, Roman, or an empire. But that's what we call it. This act controlled the history of the Middle Ages. It raised questions on the relation between these two sovereignties and the limits of jurisdiction of each. It would become a struggle of centuries. So Leo planned this, and Charlemagne was really unhappy about it. He was going to get coronated, but at the last minute, Leo moved in, and he was the one that placed the crown upon his head, which was an act, a symbolic act of saying the primary authority is the Pope. I am the one who can put the crown on your head or take the crown off of your head. I don't know why I'm doing that on the bishop's head. It just seemed like it was the closest head right there. I'm not sure. It was supposed to be a civil ceremony with the Pope there, and he steps in, grabs it, and he's the one. And the records show that Charlemagne was very angry about that because he knew what was being said. Yeah, and that became the fight. We're going to see when we get into the Middle Ages, we're going to see that event is going to control hundreds and hundreds of years, that fight between the Pope and the civil authorities. Yeah. Okay, monasticism. Before we get into monasticism, because we're talking about it in the Middle Ages here, but the beginnings of monasticism probably go back to around 250. So by the middle of the 3rd century, we start to see people going out in the... question, yeah.
Charlemagne is German or
French? He's Frankish, yeah. But, you know, the Franks are German.
Yeah, Germans, yeah.
But they've come... They're in... They're one of the German tribes, but he's French. You know, he's in Gaul. So the word France comes from Frank. Yeah, Joseph?
So the patron saint of the Irish is British, and the French are German.
Essentially.
Yep. Yeah.
So it gets real crazy. Early monasticism kind of has this big blast, and they have everybody starts outdoing one another in how much that they can suffer. So you get this whole group of they call them the pillar saints. Pillar, P-I-L-L-A-R. So they live on top of these pillars for years. Yeah, to be really holy. So there's one particular fella, my favorite, I always got to talk about him. Simon Stylites, they call him, because that's what a pillar, another term for the pillar. So you won't need to know this, just fascinating. He wanted to be the holiest monk of all. So he built this pillar. It was about 20 feet high with a platform 4x4, and he lived on it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days of the year. And people would come, you know, because that's kind of a sight. There's a man living on a post. I mean, his whole space was 4x4 on top of this pillar, and he had a bucket. You know, obviously you're wondering, how did he bucket? Lower the bucket down. His disciples would empty it. fill it up with some food, pull it back up. So he does that for a few years, and he thinks he's really getting holier. So he has another one built. Now he gets up to 30 feet. And then has another one. Finally, at the end of his life, his pillar was 60 feet high. And he lived on this pillar for 30 years. Never came down. All weather, no matter what. I mean, he was a major tourist attraction. Simon, S-T-Y-L-I-T-E-S. Stylites, I think, is from a Greek word. So he's a major tourist attraction. People come from all over the world to see it. You know when, you know the Toronto revival in the early 1900s? For 3 or 4 years, the Toronto Airport Vineyard was the number one tourist destination in all of Canada. So it was listed, it was the from the Tourist Bureau, more tourists going to the Toronto Airport Vineyard, to that revival, than any other tourist site in all of Canada. Well, Simon Stylites was the major tourist site. People come from all over the world, and he'd preach. That's what he'd do, from that pillar. He just preached. I mean, when he wasn't sleeping or eating, he was just preaching. Nonstop. I mean, it's a way to get a crowd. We used to do some crazy things out in the early days on the campus, didn't we, Julie? To get a crowd, right?
Wow, we thought we were on fire.
No, this guy's on fire. We were compromisers. That's lordship there, baby. crazy man. That's total commitment, baby. Monasticism was both a blessing and a curse to the church. In its purest form, it was a testimony against the worldliness and immorality of the great cities and a call to repentance. It was also a source of hospitality to the traveler, healing to the sick, liberality to the poor, and education to the masses. Without monasticism, there would have been very little ministry training and missionary activity during the Middle Ages. So it was a blessing in one sense. Unfortunately, monasticism also nourished a religious fanaticism. And I think Simon is a pretty good example of religious fanaticism. Promoting a righteousness of works and a legal religion. You know, it goes back to our Greek dualism that the Gnostics introduced, right? That the spiritual world is the most holy and the natural world is sinful and evil. And so the holier you get, the more you deny the physical world. And monasticism really makes the issue of Christianity about the abandonment of the world, not the transformation of the world. The gospel makes the issue the transformation of the world, but monasticism emphasized abandon the world. At least three factors that produced monasticism. Factor number one is renewal movements. Renewal movements began to grow out of a reaction to the polarization between the clergy and the laity. So if you were on the cutting edge of what God was doing in some of these periods, you were in a monastery. I mean, these are probably the remnant of the real Christians. It was like, that was what's happening. These were the renewal movements, going back to real faith in God. Number two is the development of disciplines. Disciplines to deal with the perceived dangers of the five deadly sins. Now, we normally talk about the seven. They added two later. These are the original five with the discipline. So, in a monastery, you would take a vow of poverty, a vow of chastity, a vow of prayer, a vow of study, and a vow of industry to keep you from these sins. Yeah. Yep, did. And the need for discipleship and spiritual training. All right, we're a little early. Let's just break. We'll be back at 1:30.